This episode of Off Camera is brought to you by Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code OFFCAMERA at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful. Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with actress, director, and writer Lake Bell. Lake Bell wasn't discouraged when her first punchline didn't get a laugh. Granted, she was 2 years old, and most toddlers aren't easily discouraged, but subsequent events indicate it may have had more to do with a steadfast belief in her destiny as a comedic writer and actress, and most admirably, her willingness to do the work to get there. Though Hollywood called soon after college, she went to England first to train professionally at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. Once in LA, she landed a couple of TV shows and could have easily traded on her looks for more. But she wanted to write, so she befriended a writer, learned the trade, and wrote a script, only to have it fall apart shortly before being produced. Undaunted, she went on to write In a World. Offered the chance to direct as well as star in it, she first wrote and directed a new short film just to get the experience she felt she needed. It paid off. In a World mined her own comedic vulnerability and fraught relationships to commercial and critical success. A.O. Scott of the New York Times said, "It may be that to find a leading role worthy of her gifts, Lake Bell had to make one herself. There is every reason to be glad she did." We agree, A.O. Scott, we agree. In this episode, Lake discusses the family dynamics that spurred her creativity, her love and pathological need for storytelling, the experience of simultaneously starring in and directing her first feature, and the best writing advice she received along the way, which was, ask yourself, what do you want to see next? That one's easy for us. More from Lake Bell. So pull up a chair and listen in. Hi, Lake.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Thank you for coming and doing this.
Hey, look, I'm happy to be here.
You know, I'm going to tell you a story. 2 years ago for my wife and my anniversary, we went to Santa Barbara. It was like 4 o'clock. We had a couple hours to go before dinner, and we were flipping around on the pay-per-view, and we found In a World. And we were both just blown away by your film.
Aw.
And we're just sitting there, and the film finished, and it was our whole dinner table conversation.
I love that. I love that it was part of a date night.
And an anniversary day night.
Oh my gosh.
Ever since then, I wanted to meet you and have you on here and stuff, because I did think it was an amazing film. And as the father of three daughters,
hell yeah,
it was super inspiring. And so I have a million questions about that. But before we get there, I want to like go way back. But you know, I have young girls, and my youngest is really into writing, to the point of where we actually created a creative writing class for her because she wasn't getting enough of it in school, and
right.
And she's filling up journals and notebooks and everything.
Cool.
And and I just wanted to know where the spark started with you. Like, if you remember the earliest time you had a notion that maybe you'd be in the world of storytelling or you'd be a performer or an actor.
For sure. I mean, I grew up in New York City, and my mom is sort of this stunning kind of patrician blonde, ice blue eye, beautiful woman that is very soft-spoken, but a beautiful writer and a really just phenomenal reader as well. She was almost intimidating in that way, where she could kind of like sit down with War and Peace and plow through it. And you know, for me, I was a very slow reader, and in fact, like, I was in a special class because I was so nervous about it. I don't know why I had such anxiety about it, but I remember with my mom, she sort of encouraged me to write as a way into reading, almost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I was interested in writing. I thought that was fun. I liked the idea of creating things. I also drew a lot, so, you know, we would think of ideas of way, you know, she's also a very beautiful sort of illustrator as well. She's very talented.
Wow.
And so I looked up to her and sort of her sort of arsenal of talent, and was inspired by those elements. And we started to write together. And I remember as early, super early, having an assignment of writing an autobiography. You know, when you're...
How old were you?
You know, like, really young. I want to say 10.
Wow.
You know? And you got to draw it, and you got to make a little, you know, with tape, you sort of bind it, you know, and you do the illustrations, and you do the dialogue and everything about your life. And, of course, nothing as much has happened to a person who has 10 years old. But nonetheless, you know, I was very committed to it. And fast forward to going to camp and then boarding school, and what would happen was I got into this rhythm of writing my mother to kind of keep her updated. And so these obviously before email, and even when there was email, the tradition of writing letters to my mother back and forth, and starting as early at sleepaway camp and, you know, taking a cool leaf that I found and taping it to the letter, and then being challenged about how beautiful I could make the letter and how visual, and my mom would sort of rise to the occasion and send something back that was sort of interesting. And so it became kind of a huge part of our communication and our bond. So I definitely attribute my interest in writing and my comfort and confidence in it, in my mom believing me and sort of forging it and helping nurture it.
Was there a sense even then, like, did you think, oh, I might be a writer, I might be a, like, did that ever cross your mind, or was it just a way to express yourself?
I knew that I wanted to be an actor since I was a little girl. I understood the concept of storytelling in that way, and taking on character and taking on characterizations and sort of expressing them. I thought that was cool, you know, and maybe it was escapism or just being silly, you know, the allowance card, you know, to go and be ridiculous. That type of expression was very enticing to me. I can remember as early as like being able to form words and trying to tell a joke, you know, before understanding what the rhythm of a joke was. But I liked the idea that my mom always says, "Oh, I remember when you were at the dinner table and I don't know, I had just started talking and I saw my brother tell a joke. You know, he'd say something and then everyone would laugh." And so I remember sort of, you know, stopping the conversation and saying, "To get to the other side," without any follow-up, you know, or lead-up to the end bit, and sort of nobody laughed, and I didn't understand why that didn't work. Because when he got to that line,
you're like, how does a punchline work? Yeah. Does it need a setup, or can you just go straight to
the... Can you go straight to the punchline? And incidentally, you cannot go straight to the punchline.
You need a setup.
You do need that setup. I was definitely a precocious kid who sort of, you know, probably was annoying sometimes with sort of, "Look at me, I'm doing these things."
But how did you know, like, you wanted to be an actor when you're that young to even understand that? I mean, I think my kids didn't even understand until a few years ago, my younger ones, that it's an actual job. I mean, it's just sort of storytelling.
I didn't think of it as like, well, I will get monetary compensation for this thing that I would like to do. But I think I just understood that you could, entertaining and kind of getting the attention of people and making them laugh, or, you know, doing a funny voice, or that was early. I don't know. It feels DNA based. I remember doing the Late Lake Show was a thing that I had. It was a procrastination tool.
The Late Lake Show.
Yeah, the Late Lake Show. That was to not go to bed. I would be like, you know, be like, "Okay, Lake, you know, it's time to go to bed now." And I'd be like, "Oh, hold on. I have something to tell you and show you. Here is this party, this is a show about this guy, and they're talking," and, you know, it was just like, "And also, let's take this blanket and make it I'm a queen," and, you know, it's just whatever I could think of.
Right.
And they were like, "Oh, it's so cute." And I did always buy some time before I had to go to bed, so.
You know, that is a very familiar scene at my house around bedtime.
Sure.
And it's, "Let me show you one more thing."
But there's one more thing, yeah.
So, okay, you mentioned you went to boarding school. Did you start at, like, age 14? And
boarding school at 14. I know, to think about that now. My brother went at 11, so.
Yeah. I mean, well, I grew up in a small town. My high school, my parents went to the same school. And so boarding school sounded completely East Coast and unfamiliar. But also, like, my 14-year-old self, that seems kind of scary. You know, was it just normal because of what you did, or did it make you grow up fast to all of a sudden be living on your own at 14?
I mean, my brother went to boarding school at 11, so for me, it was what cool older people did. So I really wanted to go. I was like, I want to be like my older brother, you know? And it's also a personality thing. I think I was really jazzed to kind of get out and about. And boarding school isn't really scary. It's kind of the most cush and easy way to be independent. You know, I mean, there are, after all, so many, you're living with your teachers.
Sure.
You know, there are eyes on you at all times. It doesn't feel, as a kid, you feel quite independent and sophisticated. But I never was afraid or anything. Sometimes, you know, you're also with all your friends. You, like, live, it's like a sleepover party with all your friends, and your teachers are watching.
Right.
You know?
No, I mean, it's just, you know, to me, as a parent now, being, you know, thinking about sending your kids away. It's so scary.
I think for parents, my mom sort of revealed to me recently that she, every time she would drop me off at boarding school, you know, after she would wave, she would drive out, and then she'd start pouring with tears, just like so upset. And I never understood that until I had my child, who was 4 months old.
Right.
Who at any whim, I will just be... Like, she'll smile at me, and I'm like, I love you so much. You know, just like, I could cry right now. We should shoot something dramatic.
But did you see yourself as very grown up and, like almost like an adult even then? At that
100%.
Point,
I mean, I remember being, like, when I turned 30, everyone was like, are you so scared? Are you so nervous? And I was just like, no, I've been 30 since I was 11, you know? I was like, obviously I'm 30.
So around that time, did you sort of get a little more serious about what you wanted to do? I mean, when did it change from
right.
I'm going to be the Lake Show to
right.
There's a monetary future and there's like a career in this?
From as early of an age as I can remember, I went to Chapin when I was younger, and I remember working really hard to get into any sort of play or whatever it was. I just wanted to do that, and I knew, I was very sure of it. I told, you know, family friends who would come to dinner parties, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'd be like, I'm going to be an actor. And they'd be like, no. I'm like, no, I'm serious. I'm going to be an actor. You know?
And you just knew.
I just knew. It was, and I understood that they were not trying to be patronizing, that they were just like, oh, that's sweet. And I just knew that one day they'd be like, oh, do you remember when that little girl Lake thought that she was going to be an actor? She really did. You know, I just knew I could see that whole trajectory.
What do you think gave you that confidence?
I don't know. It just was 100%. 100%.
I find that fascinating. I've had enough of these conversations to know that there's a high proportion of people that are very successful in this field that just did know. And they didn't even have any sort of negative thoughts to push them off their path.
Yeah, I think you need that. I think you need to be kind of stubborn. You need to be steadfast, like completely focused.
Yeah.
I was so focused. And I think also just personality-wise, I was very focused.
Did anyone ever try to talk you out of it?
Of course. Because my dad was like, what are you going to do? You know, these people, they try to be an actor. You know, my dad was just kind of like, you're not going to be an actor. Come on.
So in his mind, it's like
early on.
That's way too many pitfalls and everything for her to.
You have
it's
kind of
scary
plan.
To be a you father gotta, and
of
think
course.
Like, oh, my daughter's gonna be an actor.
Oh my god,
and
I totally understand.
And how many sleazy dudes is she gonna run into?
Totally. Oh, it's the worst. I don't want my daughter to be an actress.
And what would your response be to your dad when he'd be like trying to talk you out of it?
I just was like, I am gonna do that, and I don't, you know, I understand your concerns. I was again 30 at 11. I was like, I understand your concerns. I just knew I had to not speak about it. And this kind of lesson kind of took me through life. But you really can't speak about it. You just have to do. So you just have to operate and function in a way where you show versus just, like, talking about it. Like, when I wrote In a World, I didn't tell anyone about it until it was written and done.
I love that. I love that you can, you know, go in a bubble and then... Because the worst thing is, you can almost jinx something by saying, oh, I'm going to go do this.
1,000%.
Yeah.
And also for your own self, so you can drive yourself crazy. You know, if you keep saying, oh, you know, yeah, I'm working on the screenplay, I'm working on, you know, people are then going to say, how is that screenplay coming? I mean, you're going to kill yourself. I mean, it's
right.
Just the worst.
Right.
So you just, you know, I just said to my dad, I was like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But this is what we're going to do. And that said,
and did he come around?
He totally came around. I went to satiate my parents' sort of need for me to investigate other paths. I did go to Skidmore for a year to do a liberal arts education where I could take drama but also look at other things.
Right, right.
I was miserable there, not because Skidmore is a bad school. It's a great school, but it just, I knew what I wanted to do. So I'm like, why am I wasting all this time? I got to get to Hollywood. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, that's literally, I was.
So you never had this, like the theater and the highfalutin idea. You were like, well, I want to get out to Los Angeles. And
I did when I was a young kid. And then my mom said, if you're going to be an actor, you need to go to England and you need to study properly and you need to be trained. And I was like, fine, if that's what you want. So I went there for a summer thinking, I'll get this done and then I'll get out of here. So I went to RADA for a summer course, right? Just you audition, but you pay to get in.
Right, okay? Right.
So you go, and I got to England and I realized I didn't know shit. And I was like, mom's right. This is crazy. I don't know anything. This is amazing. This is, if you're a super precocious kid who's interested in being an actor, it's just like, it's just food for your desire, you know?
And England, it's true. Like, I think the best actors in the world come from there, and that there's just a tradition that's really rich.
It's respect, too. It's tradition and it's respect.
You mean within the larger community of people there, they hold actors in higher esteem than we do here.
It's culturally accepted. It's culturally interesting. And, oh, why, that's fascinating. You know, you're an actor. That's a highly respected regard. You know, my son is a doctor. Doctor, actor, whatever. The point is, they're not, it's not like my son is a doctor and, ugh, my other son's an actor, you know, AKA a waiter. You know, it's not like that there. It was so wonderful to be in a setting in a community that really inspired it versus stood on it. So I auditioned for drama schools properly, like conservatory training, and I got into this place called Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama, and that was my next.
Were you like 19 at that point?
Yeah, four years of my life in England.
What do you think the education is like over there compared to someone coming and taking some acting classes?
You know,
here?
I think what I always say is I never think that in order to be a good actor you have to go to drama school training, but what it does provide is just endurance. It's an endurance test. It's a test of your mind. Any training is like that. If you train for a marathon, it's like, it's heavily emotional and mental.
Sure.
It's discipline, you know, to learn how to kind of hang in there and stick with something in a way that inspires but also sharpens your tools.
Right.
And if you're, you know, if you want to get sort of actor school with it, the idea is, you know, you're given your body and your brain and your voice. And as an actor, if you want to get all highfalutin, that, you know, it's not, you don't have to judge it so much. It's like, it's fun. It's cool. These are your tools. So let's play with them. You know, if you're playing an intellectual, maybe you lead from your head. You know, if you're playing kind of a jock, you might lead from your dick. You know, it's like if you are playing someone who's not sure of themselves, maybe they cut their voice off. You know, if you're playing someone who feels really confident in themselves, maybe you lower it. You know, it's like
It's like amazing what you can do.
But it's like fun, you know, and that was when you're that little kid who's like, the Late Lake Show. It's just like you're feeding the fire and the desire to you know, you're hungry for it, and so it was magic.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, you know, and I think that when you take out the careerist idea of it, because I think a lot of kids that want to be an actor, what they really want to do is be famous, and so all that stuff seems more fraught with anxiety and insecurity, and they want to get through it as fast as possible. But it sounds like you went and genuinely fell in love with the process of it. And
I think early on, when you're a kid and you're one of those people who are like, I want to be an actor, it's very earnest. It's very sweet, and it's just that feeling of wanting to storytell.
Right.
And then somewhere along the way, you get enticed and seduced by the idea of notoriety and the sexiness of what it could be to be like some starlet or, you know, whatever that, right? It's just intoxicating. You know, we're all infatuated with it. And then, you know, if you can grow up out of that, you know, and realize, yes, there's power in that, and that's intoxicating into itself. But if you can find what you loved about it when you were just little, you know, and the play of it, then you can start living without that anxiety.
Right.
And I'm very lucky that I didn't, you know, kind of do one movie and all of a sudden I was a box office star, you know. I am very happy with how it, for my personality, how it sort of is like gently, oh, and a little step up and a little step up and kind of, you know, getting to work with people that I think are really cool and
right.
Getting to make my own, tell my own stories and collaborating with people, finding the right team, the right nice, you know, sort of in being, expressing myself in an enjoyable and safe and respectful way versus it's a lot of pressure. I mean, to burst into stardom and
right.
It's cool. It's what I thought I wanted when I was a kid. You know, I was like, oh, if I could just get on, get a starring role,
right.
I could just get a starring role, and then I'd be famous. And then I could do anything. You know.
Hey, folks. Let's talk about video for a minute. Do you know there are 4 billion video views a day on YouTube? The world loves video, but it's hard to produce. Animoto has changed all that and wants to give you their video maker to try and see for yourself how easy it is. Animoto is a drag and drop video builder that gives you everything you need to produce professional videos in minutes. You just need a logo and some photos or video clips. They make it so easy to share what you're all about. Best of all, you can share Animoto videos anywhere online, or you can download them and burn them to a DVD and send them to your grandmother. When I think of all the time I spent as a young professional photographer and director, creating my portfolio and putting together my reel, I realize I was born 10 years too early because Animoto would have made that work so much easier and so much better. I mean, I know I sound like the old man, but kids today have it easy now. With Animoto, you can create a really amazing way to showcase your work as a creative. So if you want to give it a try, visit animoto.com/offcamera to sign up for their free 14-day trial. When you're ready to purchase, just use the promo code offcamera and get a 15% discount off an annual pro subscription. And now let's get back to my conversation with Lake Bell.
I was reading an interview with you where you were talking about beauty and being that next girl and how that can get you in the room. But at the same time, I sort of read a subtext or an undercurrent to your comments, which is that if you don't sort of have your own sort of plan for how you want your career to go, that can also be dangerous to sort of get swallowed up in the expectation of, oh, I'm the next girl that is being wooed by Hollywood. Or you know, I guess I'm asking, is there a dangerous aspect to getting what you maybe wanted when you didn't know what you want? Like the idea
right.
of if you did get a giant starring role, like you get a Michael Bay film and all of a sudden you're that for a minute. I mean, did you think consciously, I want to hone my career path in a way that makes sense for me? Or did it just sort of, did that come through experience?
I think particularly with girls too, you know, you end up in a situation where you are wooed by opportunity, and it's very easy to go down the wrong path. And
right.
However, I do feel that if whoever is inside you, you know, the true artist or whatever, if you find your true creative self, that eventually that does roll out. Whether you suppress it because you are enticed to sell yourself to the devil or whatever it is, you know, perhaps go down a path of vanity or whatever mm-hmm. it is. Because we're all naturally vain and somewhat egocentric because
sure.
in order to do what we do, you have to kind of love thyself or sort of be aware of thyself. And that's okay by me. But I do think that in a way, going down the path of just being the hot girl or whatever it is, if maybe you're more than that, then that leads to good old-fashioned unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
mm-hmm.
just sad. It's arrested development. I mean, some people come out to Hollywood. I've met a number of people who, when they say that when you land in Hollywood, that's the age that you remain at.
That's funny because there's a saying about child abuse that too, and it's they say that if a kid is abused, their development sort of stops at the age they were abused, and they even talk about it with voices where sometimes by the way someone talks that they can sort of determine the age that the child was abused.
Interesting.
I've never heard it applied to Hollywood that way. That's sort of where your growth stops. Yeah, because it's true. I guess the minute you become famous, you stop really being able to trust anyone new.
And it's hard to evolve.
If you didn't have a good, solid group of friends and family or whatever, yeah, how do you evolve when you're under a microscope?
Exactly. You can't evolve within the bubble.
Right.
You know, it's like you can only evolve if you work really hard to not get held down by that sort of weight of well, you're expected to be this and that. That's why you see a lot of women trying to, you know, they're gorgeous 40-something-year-old women really trying to look 20, you know?
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah.
And I'm like, but you're not 20, but you're gorgeous and you're 40. I don't like that women are in a situation where, you know, a woman of a certain age has to feel like she has to look of a certain... She has to have this, like, youth obsession. On the other path, you know, if as a director, you know, as a writer and director, I like to express my femininity and my sexuality. If I'm naked on the cover of a magazine, you know, and someone says, well, why do you think you have to do that? Because you're a woman and, you know, you're a writer, director, you don't have to do that. I'm like, I know I don't have to. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
You kidding me? I can. You know, like, they're not asking, like, it's just I want to express myself in that way, and it's like it feels sexy. It feels beautiful. It's beautiful.
Do you remember the first time you had to defend yourself on that?
I think only more recently, because only more recently have I been sort of regarded as someone who is
right. But it's a funny conversation because I know what you're saying. You're saying that in some people's minds, those two things have to be mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
Either you're smart and brainy and feminist and you've decided to take that route, or you're sexy and you're, you know, it really shows the limitations of the person doing the criticizing, that they don't think that could be in one
person.
Well,
it's only been men that I've heard that from, actually. Like, where it's on Twitter, it's on the Twitterverse, you know, where someone... the majority of the people are like, you go, girl, you know, or
right.
Like, yay, women, writing and also sexy. And then, like, one guy will be like, why do you think you have to do that? Not to say that they speak that way, but, you know, the idea is, like, why do you have to do that? And I'm like, great question, because if you're thinking about it that way, that's the idea of you even asking that question is an interesting discussion,
right.
You know, Ben Affleck, who's an actor and a very good-looking dude, who... you know, is a great director.
Yeah.
Like, phenomenal director.
Really good director.
He, you know, is on the cover of magazines looking sharp as hell.
Right.
Sexy, whatever, right? And, you know, I'm sure he doesn't get that kind of criticism, you know, because...
No, he does not.
You know, I'm now part of an organization called Women in Film, and, you know, I actually am inspired by the current state of... affairs in Hollywood with ladies. You know, when I had In a World and it came out at Sundance, it was in competition there with half of the filmmakers there were women. And that was very rare. But that year it was, I think, really symbolic and inspiring for me to kind of be among, to be in that community and also feel that women were equally represented.
Well, let's get into that. Because I read that you, when you first started writing, you were on a television show, and you tell the story of how you sort of, because I think it's a good setup for this.
Yeah.
How you would sort of pop your head in the writer's room and.
Yeah, I remember I was doing Mismatch for Darren Star, and it was me and Alicia Silverstone. It was her show, Ryan O'Neill and James Roday, and I, you know, played literally the, you know. Booby, brunette, funny sidekick, best friend type thing for Alicia Silverstone. And we became dear friends after that. But she's awesome. But I definitely was like her like goofy, bleh, like slutty, you know, kind of friend. And it was super fun. But I always had all these ideas for the show and for my character and other characters too, and storylines and things. So I sort of befriended one of the writers on the show, and then she sort of told me how it works on, in a TV show, how there's a writer's room. There's this, like, this magic room where everybody shares stories and they talk about, you know, their, you know, weird camp stories and upbringing and, like, weird sexual experiences and all these things, and then all of a sudden scripts procure, you know?
And you're young at this time.
I mean, I just got to Hollywood. I was probably, like, 22, 23.
Okay.
And
so you're just learning the ropes.
Yeah, like, I had just come from England where we did, like, Neutral Mask, and we will be water coming out of a faucet. Go. You know? And you're just like, what? So I was, you know, doing, you know, check off. To, you know,
to mismatch.
Tis pity she was a whore, you know, tis, you know, just Elizabethan dramas, and then to Darren Star, and which was super fun, and I just remember pitching all these ideas, and you know, like, I want to be part of this writer's room, while I was like head to toe and like hair and makeup and stupid earrings and lace hand, you know, lace gloves and things like that that they would dress me in, platforms and boobs, I don't know, lots of boobs. And she was just like, are you like a closet writer or something? Like, do you have something you want to tell us, you know? And I was like, yes, I am. I'm a closet writer, you know? And so I came out of the writing closet in those days and ended up sort of latching on to this one girl who thought I was funny and had interesting things to say, and we became writing partners for a stint and wrote a screenplay that I'm really proud of to this day. It never got made, but...
Wow. Before that happening, had you made an attempt at writing a screenplay on your own, or did
you... I had a secret... I remember it's like on a floppy disk or something. Like, I had a super old computer that had a floppy disk involved with it. That's all I know. Because I remember finding this box of floppy disks of this screenplay that I was writing.
Called, do you remember the title?
Yes. It was called Belle and Stella. It's like the worst screenplay ever.
Was it a TV or was it a movie?
It was a movie, and it was like about a girl who like went to drama school and came out to, you know, came out to England, and like it was her best friend, you know, that she had this best friend who, it was just horrible. But it you know, it was like two friends, one that worked really, really hard her whole life, and the other one that was really nice, but just really beautiful. And they go to Hollywood, and it was my biggest fear. It was like the one that trained and gave up all the hot years, because I thought I gave up all my hot years.
At 22?
To drama school.
Isn't it funny how we always think we're too late?
I know.
For whatever we're doing?
I think it was because I came to Hollywood for one summer while I was still at drama school and got a callback for Felicity and like had to go back to drama school, and I thought, there was my opportunity. I fucking failed. Like, I blew it. I could have been.
And that was your hot moment. Yeah, then you came back, you were old.
Yeah, and then I was old. I was 22. I mean, it was past. But it was an exercise in writing dialogue.
Okay.
For me. So I had you know, even just the format of writing. It was just a place that I could go to practice, you know? It wasn't a screenplay that I felt like I would ever show to anyone. It was literally just, you know, we had done minimal stuff at drama school, which is basically theater-based. You know, we did a little bit of cinematic training, but not really. And so it was just to understand the physicality of writing something like that, the formatting, and just, you know, kind of improvising with myself and sort of laying scenes out that way.
How did you learn?
That girl that I ended up partnering with, she and I were great companions because she was, you know, super regimented, very, you know, story structure.
So she had read books and structure and
exactly.
All that stuff.
And so hanging out with her and writing with her for years, because we ended up writing together for nearly 2 years on this one screenplay. Didn't tell my agents about it at all until it was ready. So for 2 years, and that was like a college-level course in story structure. I mean,
no kidding.
Yeah, and then I had always been obsessed with, like, I wanted to, you know, I knew what always would happen next, and like how the characters would talk and what they look like, and you know, and the description. And I would always, you know, I've been writing letters to my mom about, you know, which is ostensibly like prose, and I would make, you know, I would write poetry to my mom. You know, it was very, where the writing part of it wasn't daunting. You know?
It was okay.
The story structure was more daunting because I just was like, I don't know. You know, and she was actually a great teacher, though, this woman who she always said to me, well, what do you want to see next? It was the best writing advice I'd ever gotten. What do you want to see next? Like,
right.
It's very simple.
Right.
Like, you stop thinking. Don't think about, like, the audience. You know, like, don't judge yourself. Just don't limit yourself. You can always rewrite. And by the way, you will 100,000 times. But for now, what do you want to see next?
Right, but that didn't get made, that particular one?
That one didn't get made. That whole thing got set up and almost happened and then fell
okay,
apart.
Tell me about that, because it's amazing how many projects don't get made and
yeah.
how hard it is to have the timing and the financing and the casting and to make it all work. It's all, people talk about the movie gods because
yeah.
it just, you know. It's so did that one come close?
Very close.
And were you going to direct?
No, she was going to direct. We had written it for her, for me to star in, for her to direct it. She was interested in that. And for us to write together.
Okay.
And
so you're still pretty young at this point. Like
yeah, I was.
So you knew you wanted to be on this path.
Oh, yeah.
Creating your own material.
Indeed. And then, you know, we got it set up and it was like, you know, we found producers and we had a great cast and we got all the way to the end and, you know, to point of sessions and everything. And then something personal happened with one of the people involved. And so it was like this and it just went away just as quick as it had come together.
That must have been so painful.
And it was years of work.
Yeah.
And so you know, I always thought maybe it'll come back around again, but I was kind of burned on the idea of writing something at that point.
Right.
So a couple years passed until I started to think about In a World.
How did you sort of gear back up to write In a World, and was that an idea that you were kicking around for a while? Because I think that sometimes the hardest thing is coming up with an original germ of an idea that you can't poke holes in, right? And especially if you can create a world that people haven't really gotten to enjoy before. Like, you found something that hasn't really been cinematically
explored.
Told and explored, yeah. Like, how did it come to you? Were you sitting in a movie theater listening to trailers, or?
You know, it's super organic how it happened. I am personally, you know, given my background and what I'm interested in, really into voice. And I'm hyper aware of mine, I'm hyper aware of other people's. It can affect, you know, can ruin my day, you know, or can make it brighter, you know. And I just notice it. So especially going to drama school, you know, working on the voice and as I was playing with it before, and accents and dialects were very important to me. And so that sort of rolls into voice in general and how it sort of affects us culturally and where it's used. And I've always loved the, you know, the manipulation that the voice can take on for trailers and movie trailers and this sort of omniscient thing telling us how to feel and what we, you know, what we should drink and what we should buy and what fabric softener we should buy, you know, or what film we should watch. And it's always this male voice. And I thought, God, you know, because I always used to do In a World. And I wondered if I had ever heard a woman say those words and whether that was so strange to me. And I remember talking to a friend of mine and saying, God, wouldn't it be funny if there was, like, a movie, or, like, a comedy, obviously, about a woman who sort of sets out to be the first woman to utter those words, you know? That was an original conceit. And she was like, that's a short film. And I was like, all right, Caddy, you're not my friend anymore. and I said, you know, and then I was thinking about it, well, it wouldn't just be about that journey. It would be about a myriad of other things that I'd like to discuss, you know, and in a therapeutic way about family and whatnot. But, and so that's where I got the idea for this sort of father-daughter competition story where my father and I have an interesting relationship. And I sort of looked more to his relationship to my brother, because my dad is in real estate and he owns race car tracks, and that is a huge part of his life, racing and amateur racing, but still going fast and dangerous. And he and my brother always had a interesting dynamic where
competition.
Yeah, where it was like my brother wasn't really into the competition aspect of it, but my dad would sort of feel a little bit sticky on that. Where I hear about parents talking about their children and wanting them to succeed, and oh God, you're faster than me, kid. You know, like that kind of a thing. And I always thought that would be a great response, but I was like, God, my dad isn't that. That's not my dad's sort of like, well, you almost caught up to me. You know, like father, like son. You know, kind of a little edgy. Where
right,
I was like,
right.
Well, that doesn't feel good. That feels, I'm bummed on my dad for that. You know,
right.
And so that dynamic, which I had never seen with a daughter. And a father.
I hadn't either in a film.
Well, it came up a little bit. I feel like I've told my dad this, and I feel bad for him, sort of. He's an amazing man. But he's flawed, like we all are. And when I started writing for The Hollywood Reporter, I do a test drive column. I used to for a couple years. You know, I did it and took it on because I was so excited to share that with my father. And I was...
Right. Let me just make sure people understand that. So you okay. write a column in The Hollywood Reporter, and you actually get to take fast cars out and review them.
Yes.
And sort of have a different perspective on it. And
yeah, and it comes from, like, a lady and a comedic perspective. And
right.
Sort of, it's anecdotal. It's not like I'm an expert in, you know, under the hood. But I can speak to...
No, but I read one that you did about, I think, an Aston Martin, where you mm-hmm. really described it in a metaphorical way that was great. You know, in more of a masculine, feminine way that I thought was
the
a different
horror.
Take. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'm saying. I think, you know, I enjoyed it very much for when I did it because I grew up with a father who was absolutely obsessed. And the only way that I could access him and access our relationship was via something that had to do with cars. So
you felt the obligation to, like, learn about that so you guys could connect.
Kind of. Or I always feel like I accidentally learned a lot about cars. I didn't, you know, I liked cars. I just... would look at them through my dad's eyes, and he would explain to me what he thought was interesting and cool. He'd be like, oh, you don't like that one. That one's not, you know, that's no good because of this, this, and that. And I would be like, yeah, I guess you're right. Or, but what about, you know, and I started looking at them critically as art pieces
uh-huh.
and as experiential kind of vessels, you know, like how does it make you feel? You know, like listen to that, listen to the sound, look at the smell. You know, it's like, well, yeah, I could get into this, you know, like this is fun. He would take me to the auto show every year at Javits. That was one of our only father-daughter moments early on that I can remember well, where he was excited. And to see my dad excited about anything was just really interesting. And so when I had this car column, I remember coming to him, and this is where the thematic comes in. I said, you know, I was like, oh, I'm going to do this, and my dad's going to finally, like, really think I'm cool, you know? And I told him about it, and... he read it, and he was like, and he said to my brother, he's like, she has someone write it for her. I was like, you know, she has like a ghost writer or something.
So he didn't believe you wrote it.
And I remember my brother telling me that, and I was like, what? Are you serious? Like, it was heartbroken.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
He just didn't feel that I had that in me, and that I, you know, it felt competitive in nature. It felt like that's my thing. You know, like I don't believe that you know anything about that, you know. And as a daughter, to feel that from your dad, I was like, that feeling is interesting, as even a writer, right? Someone
yeah.
who's going to tell a story. And
well, that's exactly the feeling you create in a world in the right from the beginning, where there's just that thing where the dad is missing this amazing daughter he has right there in his house, sleeping on his couch, and is just
yeah.
missing it. And when you describe it that way, like. You know, the question I was going to ask is, do you need to draw from real life experiences to to be able to sort of do what you did. And now I...
Absolutely.
Yeah. I watched it a second time in preparing for you coming in here. And one of the things that stuck out to me this time around would be what a tragic father figure I would be if I couldn't be happy for my daughter's success. Especially when...
I hear you. I'm like, I'm going to cry. It's just... I agree. What a tragedy.
Yeah.
Being a parent is really interesting. You know, I mean, even looking at the film now newly being a parent and thinking, God, that is gut-wrenching, you know, the idea of not being able to be proud of your child. I think in speaking to the protagonist as well, Carol, who I play, I didn't want something to be overly kind of like her whole life is a fucking train wreck. It's not like that. It's not extremist,
no.
You know.
No, it's not.
Because it's more like, well, sometimes, you know, you can be attractive and also, you know, but just not, you know, you're not doing, you know, drinking too much and hungover and this and that. You know, it's the subtleties of sort of someone's arrested development or miniature demise or whatever it is. It's just all relative, you know, to that person. And I didn't, especially as a female protagonist, I felt like I had seen other things where people were like really in the shit dump, you know, and then, or they're just kind of, you know, powerful, but they don't have it together, you know, at home. And like, they've got the career. And yeah, it's like, it's so like polarized, you know.
Right.
Versus things are kind of just, you know, muddy in the middle, you know.
Right.
Yeah, it's hyper personal. I think, you know, to write anything in order to have the tolerance to keep going and the gusto to keep going, you have to draw from things. I always say that therapy is the best writing tool there is. It's mm-hmm. the most amazing tool in my arsenal, certainly. You know,
well,
I use myself.
It's a forced examination, right?
Exactly.
You got it, yeah. Well, there's two very interesting choices in the film that I thought you made that were sort of the ones that stuck with me in a weird way. One, you know, your decision to have your character sleep with Gustav Warner.
And that was totally a what do I want to see next moment.
Because, it was.
Yeah, because it's the moment where, and by the way, as a, personally, I have been in situations where I have chosen to do things stupidly and like, how did I end up in this situation and yet I'm here?
You're not talking about right now.
No.
Okay.
No,
anyway,
this is
ahead.
Great. But I remember writing this whole sort of Gustav love triangle with her and Lewis and like, why would I sleep with that asshole? But I've been in situations where I'm like, why didn't I sleep with that asshole? You know, so I can only say that it's just realistic, you know, and it's the very person that, you know, it's like Romeo and Juliet, you know, it's like the very person you shouldn't sleep with or that you shouldn't fall for, you know, or even it's the bad boy syndrome, which I have really had to work myself out of that, the whole sort of bad boy thing, which like perfectly smart, interesting, intelligent women who torture themselves with dating people who are scummy, you know, or clinical narcissists, you know. So that was just a personal kind of, that I just related to that.
Right.
Where the very person that you shouldn't, you do.
Right, right. We're so conditioned to know what an American movie arc
right.
looks like, that when it doesn't happen that way, it kind of throws you off a little bit, you know? And then in the end, you realize, oh, no, that was a more realistic movie-going experience.
If I'm writing an original piece, I like much more. I lean into what do I want to see next, and I'm playful, and I'm, you know, I don't judge it if it doesn't fit into the milestones that I'm supposed to hit.
Right.
And then later, because it's all about rewriting anyway, so it's like later you can, you know, you can move things around and squeeze things to
So was
to
it fit. Much longer at first and got shorter, that film? And
It's interesting. It was just more sort of killing babies and replacing them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had to rewrite. I shot a scene between Dimitri and I, Lewis and Carol, and it was a pivotal scene. It's when he lets Carol know that actually her dad is actually in the running and he knows he's privy to that information. It was a really pivotal scene. I wanted it to be really funny and endearing and cool and also a romantic scene between them. And but also get out this really big piece of information.
Right.
So it's like, fucking exposition. You know, it was a little challenging. And we finally got to that scene, and it was like I was losing the light, and there was assholes driving by with the honking of the horn and taking photos, and it was like really edgy on set that day. It was the only time it was edgy. And, you know, I was like, I have $4 to make this movie. Can you go away? You know, like it was just, and I couldn't get my head in the game. And so the performances were a little off. And I gave it to my editor, and he was like, you need to reshoot the scene.
Mm.
And I was like, I don't have I can't reshoot anything. I have no time. There's nothing. We can't. And he's like, I also think you should look at rewriting it, you know. And I just, it's just with all the prep. And I rewrote the scene, and it's the one where Lewis and Carol are walking down the red wall.
Yeah, when he brings the tea to you and
and he says, you know, I'm like, he's like, you know, I'm really into the cranberries, and I'm like, zombie or linger.
That's right.
Yeah, I always picked you as a zombie. You know, that whole and positive roadblocking and everything, that all came from the rewrite.
Oh, that was
on
a
the
rewrite.
Fly.
Okay.
Like that was a new scene that had just come out of nowhere, and there was no positive roadblocking before, and there was no, you know, it was too serious before, and I kind of lightened it. I'm so thankful for that.
It's funny because that scene is the scene on which the movie turns.
Yes.
It really is. It's when Dimitri decides to make a decision.
Yeah, he gets on the front
Lewis
foot.
And it turns you.
And she says, I like you.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like all of a sudden, whoa, lots of
By the way, the way you handled that was so good, too, because you're so distracted through the whole scene because of your sister, and then you say, I like you, but then you made the decision to turn back and say it again. I thought that was brilliant. Really, really good.
Thanks.
So at what point in writing this film did you know you were going to direct it, or did you know the entire time?
Yeah, I knew. Well, no, that's not true. Initially, I had written it to star in. I was like, this is what I'd like to do.
Now, did you write that to give yourself the kind of role that you wanted to play, or did you write it just because?
It was a fancy experiment of, like, here's something I'd like to play, and also, here's something I'd like to write, you know, because I wrote solo on that one, so that was kind of a new thing. I'd like to curate this creative experience. You know, I want to curate the right people. I want to kind of produce it. You know, I presented it to my agents. I said, this is, you know, after I had written it, I just presented it. And they were like, what? What is this? Oh, okay. Great, let's go make it, you know. And we were shopping for directors.
Oh, so you were? Okay, so you didn't know you were going to direct
Correct,
it.
Initially. And then my agent, Billy Lazarus, said, he called me and he just was like, look, you're going to direct eventually, right? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, eventually I'm going to find somebody. He's like, why don't you direct In a World? And I was like, I've never directed anything. I would never take on a fucking feature film. I'm not a lunatic. And he's like, so write a short film and direct that. And I was like, all right, I gotta go. I gotta write something. You know, so then
You had In a World written before you made your short film, Worst Enemy.
Correct.
No kidding. So and that I, was, that. Well, you really do your homework.
I did. I was like, I've got to get off the phone now. You know, and then I was like, ding, 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 you know.
And then once you directed that, you're like, I can go do my feature.
The first day on set, I was like, I'm home. I love this shit. I was like, because you think, oh, I might be good at that, just given my personality. I might be good at directing. But you don't know until you practice it, until you're in it. And then I knew.
Well, I noticed you also surrounded yourself with a lot of actors that are in other projects with you, like Children's Hospital and everything. Was that a conscious thing to make sure on your first film that you weren't going to have a bunch of unknown entities?
Absolutely. I mean, I hope to always sort of, you know, pepper the cast with people that I love and trust and
That's great. You got your own troupe, sort of.
Totally.
Hey, folks. You know, the ads in this particular episode are making me feel old. I want to talk to you now about Squarespace, which is a great website builder. I remember the first time I built a website for my photography and directing work. And I hired these guys, and I think it took them 3 months to build it, and it was so expensive. And then it never really worked right. And then the guys moved to Paris, so if I wanted to have any kind of tech support, I had to call them at 3 a.m. But now there's an easier way. There's Squarespace. And I'll tell you, if I had Squarespace back then, I would have saved myself so much time and money and headaches. Because, you know, creating something that looks good and works well is a time-consuming affair. Whether it's for a creative portfolio like mine, or a restaurant, or whatever else, in this day and age, you probably need one anyway. Well, lucky for us, Squarespace makes it easy to build beautiful websites without breaking a sweat.
With Squarespace, websites look professionally designed regardless of your skill level. There's no coding required, and they have intuitive and easy-to-use tools. And with their state-of-the-art technology powering your site, you can be sure that your site will be secure and stable at all times. It's trusted by millions of people, and the best part of it, it starts at $8 a month, and you get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So what are you waiting for? Sign up for Squarespace. Start your free trial site today. There's no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com, and when you sign up, make sure to use the offer code OFFCAMERA to get 10% off of your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
I also wondered if when you were sort of visually thinking about this and structuring it and everything, if there's a certain director or auteur that you tonally love, is there someone there that's sort of like your visual mentor or mentor from afar?
Yeah, I mean, the movies that turned me on visually, you know, definitely Paul Mazursky and, you know, even like early Milos Forman kind of films and Woody Allen, just tonally and visually.
I was going to mention Woody Allen.
I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, well, that's kind of cliche. Yeah, well, it's cliche for a reason, you know, because he's great.
Because he's great.
He's phenomenal. And definitely, you know, I think they're, you know, the naturalistic and also sort of cinematic sort of mixture that cocktail that he always seems to deliver. Certainly his early movies like Your Hannah and Your Sisters and, you know, Alice. And it's interesting to look at those movies and then think about how I can, you know, be inspired by them, but then also kind of translate it into my own visual conversation and tonal conversation.
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm not into sort of running and gunning it and just sort of like popping it off and, you know, it's okay if it's a little messy. That doesn't interest me as much. I do enjoy something a little more timeless, more controlled. You know, I like to be in studio, I like to be in Dolly, you know, and kind of, you know, use, you know, a visual feeling palette and even just in color and texture, something that feels almost 70s-esque and things that I saw in early 80s.
I felt that in the film. Like when you go to the party, the camera takes on a very party movement, like a dollied slow pass through the party thing that was actually did feel more like a classic film. And,
yeah.
And I noticed that. You go to Sundance, you don't have a distributor, and you have this film, and up till this point, no one really knows. Like, it's like your thing where you don't tell anybody.
Oh, all totally.
Of a sudden,
I
it's
loved
your
it.
Giant coming out party. Tell me about that experience. Like, what was the quintessential or the sort of most indelible memory of that Sundance experience for you?
The whole Sundance experience comes from the starting point would be submitting. So, you know, it's like I my most memorable moment probably even comes in the beginning when I cared so much. It's on my bucket list. Like Sundance was, you know, people would always talk about going to Sundance and, you know, getting crazy boots and like comfy, wumpy, you know, sweaters and like, oh, it's so crazy. We had to go for this. And that. I just heard about Sundance, you know, and I'd see pictures in the Entertainment Weekly of like all the gallery of people who would be there. And I'd be like, shit, one day I want to be there, you know. And I would get invited every year just because they like actors there,
sure.
You know. And people would be like, oh, yeah, you can go get a free iPod or something, you know. It was back in iPod days. And I vowed to never go until I had a reason. I was like, no. And so when Worst Enemy got accepted in competition as a short film into Sundance, I was like, finally. And I'm going there not even as an actor. So I can get that free iPod as a director, you know? And that experience was totally mind-blowing because I was there on such a different reason. And it was just a beautiful kind of like warm welcome. The community of Sundance is beautiful. I mean, it's for a filmmaker, it's a hearth, you know, of creatives and the most beautiful version of networking, you know,
right.
It's sort of community, you know, and they even call it like the class of, 11 or the class, you know, that sort of, I think, insinuates what kind of feeling it is. So submitting in a world, I cared so much. I wanted to do them proud. They were excited to see, you know, their short film directors take on a feature and to see how they do it. So they came at it from a place of wanting us to do well. But then it's almost like it felt like college. I really felt like what it would feel like to want to impress a professor, you know, or an institution. I wanted to do good by them. You know, they believed in me early on. I was like, shit, I want to deliver. It meant so much to me, you know. And I was in England with my husband, who was covered in tattoos. He's a tattoo artist. And I was in England with him, and I had just submitted, and I just had a quiet moment, and I started to, like, really obsess and get very quiet. And he sort of looked at me and he said, are you okay? And I was like, I'm just thinking. And he's like, is it about Sundance? And I just immediately started crying. And he was like, oh God, what do I do? Oh, why did I just, oh God, what can I do? And so he looked around and he takes a knife out and he takes an iPhone charger.
Yeah.
And he starts like ripping at it and he's like opening up the wires. And I'm like, what are you doing? And he didn't have a converter. He fashions sort of electrical charge with the wire to make one of his tattoo guns work. And he goes, tattoo Sundance on me, and it'll come true. And I was like, I'm not tattooing, I've never tattooed. And he's like, do it. And I was like, no. He's like, do it here. I'm like, all right, well, if I'm not doing it right there. I'll do it somewhere else. You know, I pick his leg on top of another crazy tattoo he's got. So it's somewhere that if I, you know, screw it up. So I'm just sitting there with tears, and I'm just
this
like.
This is an insane story.
And it's like, you know, and it's like, S-U-N.
I hope you spelled it right.
I wrote Sundane.
You did?
And so I was like, N, and then I was like, E, oh, wait, oh, no, wait, hold on. And he's like, oh, wow, you know. And I was like, I forgot the C, hold on. And I just did it over the E, and then, you know, and then finished it out. And he's like, do you want anything else? Do you want to do anything else towards it? I was like, yeah, probably two arrows pointing to it. And he's like, okay, do the two arrows. And sure enough. He's the best husband.
You tattooed Sundane.
Sundane with two arrows. And I remember, you know, finally, you know, we get word that it got in, you know.
That's love.
And right it was there. A beautiful moment. He brought balloons, and I was like, crying. I was so excited, jumping up and down. And I'm like, we got into Sundane, you know. And that year, it just so happened that the kind of theme, the visual theme for Sundance that year were arrows. And so it was just all these arrows, like, kind of going like this. And it was, like, the exact arrows that I had tattooed on them. So,
wow.
So now, you know, I'm really proud to be a part of the Sundane Film Festival alumni.
Obviously, you have your big premiere and no one's seen it yet. What's that? What's the audience response like, and how is that experience for you?
I mean, the most amazing, you're right, there was a pivotal moment because my experience of, you know, that feeling, that buzz, that, oh, you know, the butterflies in your stomach, the night your movie is premiering at Sundance at the Library, which is a wonderful theater, full of all kinds of magic juju. And we're all in there. My whole family has come in, divorced or not. You know, everyone flew in, like, get over it. Everyone sit down, you know. So we've got all kinds of steps and haves and, you know, leave your lawyers at home. And so everyone's there, and I could care less about that shit at that point. And, you know, you've got your, you know, the Weinstein Company and all the distributors and all the, you know, kind of peppered in the audience. And the lights go down, and there's a really special moment. You know, whatever their little bumper is, the thing that they play in the beginning, that's like Sundance, stories, you know, or whatever it is. So that comes on, and my heart is racing. And the lights go down. And the whole thing, I kept saying to them, I was like, it's at Dolby 7. Play it at Dolby 7.
You know? Right.
I was like, it is mixed for Dolby 7. And I was like, it's a digital, it's so weird not having a film reel. It's just like a digital little, it's like, here's your film. And it's play it.
Yeah.
And so they just press play. And you know, it goes dark and nothing. There's nothing going on. I'm thinking, please, the only thing I didn't want to happen is a digital problem or something. I see the lights in the projector booth come up. I'm like, that's not good. So they're like turning it on. There's something going on. So then I see Trevor like coming down to the podium being like, hey, we're having a bit of a technical problem. So just bear with us. I'm like, you know, just freaking out. And then the lights go down and sure enough, you know, it plays beautifully. And it was, it was a magic, a truly magic moment. And I'll never forget it for the rest of my life. So we were at the award ceremony and, you know, I'm feeling loose and they present the award for best sound design. And all of a sudden I was like, sound design? I didn't realize there was a sound design award. And all of a sudden I was like, oh my God, all right, I'm gonna listen. Maybe, I don't know, because they started describing a movie that took, you know, sounds and really put them to the forefront of our consciousness and understanding. And also was playful with the idea of, you know, they're like describing this thing and I'm like, oh my God, we have a shot, you know? And I'm getting like nervous and kind of excited and my producers are kind of kicking me and I'm like, no, I mean, we probably won't. And you know, they call out somebody else's name and I'm like, oh, yeah, no, obviously we're not winning anything. Right. Yeah, that's what I thought. It's not even like I lost anything because I did. You know, so then I was like, another beer. And so then, you know, beers are flying. And then they're you know, they're about to present the screenplay. And I'm looking around and I see I'm like some other friends. I'm like, yeah, I'll go. And I'm not paying attention. And they start describing this movie. And then all of a sudden, in the description, like I really wasn't paying attention. In the description, they started to say something about the voiceover world, and I was like terror, just terror. I was like, oh my God, this is not happening. I'm like, put this beer down. And then I was just like, sweat. You know, just so nervous. And they called out in a world. And I just, I got up there and I'll say what I said there, which was like, I can't believe that, you know, I've written this movie about voices, and yet I'm rendered speechless. Like, oh. And but was, you know, profoundly moved, and it was hugely inspiring to, and it changed my life, really.
Oh,
you know?
Oh my gosh, what an amazing experience! And I had sort of the same reaction after I saw it that a lot of reviewers did. I went and read like the Rotten Tomatoes reviews, and more than a couple times, the reviewer would express, like, I want to see what Lake Bell, the filmmaker, does next.
Right.
And, I mean, did that feel like pressure, or did that feel like...
I mean, it does feel like pressure, but it's kind of the coolest pressure ever. It's like, it goes back to being, you know, my mom being like, this is great, you know, you should, you know, let's keep writing, and let's, you know, let me encourage you to do these things. I mean, it's a nice thing. There's pressure because you need pressure in order to create a little bit, you know,
yes.
Whether you put it on yourself or you want to, like when I think about, I want to make sure that I deliver something that I'm proud of to Sundance as an institution.
Like, right.
I enjoyed having the institution to work for. So I take it really seriously in trying to produce something that I'm really proud of, but I don't take it so seriously that I think I'm curing cancer, you know, because then it's not fun.
Right.
We're making movies. It's really fun and it's really cool, but
yeah.
it's not grave, you know.
Well, what was it like to go back to just acting in those two films I mentioned? I mean, how did your experience change?
It was a vacation.
It felt like a vacation. Right.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is great.
But did it change the conversation?
Where do I stand? Can I get a coffee? You know.
Well, it's amazing, you know, to be an actor and to have a front row seat. Mm-hmm. To every different kind of problem-solving situation. I mean, being an actor and then going over to direct, I would think, is so much easier than being a director who's never acted.
I would agree.
You know
with
what
that.
I mean? Like, I think that, and I'm sure there's so many actors that don't take advantage of this and don't, because you can actively pay attention or you can just sort of
totally
tune out, right?
And you go back to your trailer.
Right.
Just like, farting around and watch YouTube videos if you want.
Right.
Which I do sometimes too. But
there's time for everything.
There's time for everything. I just, you're right. I learned to direct from staying, when they say, do you want to go back to your trailer and just relax? I'd be like, no, I'm good. I'll stick around crafty and then I might look around. You know, so you can go and be like, hey, what's the difference between like a 45 and a 35? You know, I mean, if you're a respectful kind of quiet observer, you don't get in people's way, you know, and you don't, you're not annoying. If you can just have the focus to just observe at how this amazing machine runs, which is truly cool. I just remember first being on a set and looking at just like the camera, you know, there was like two cameras, there's like, what is that? That's the, you know, okay, so we've got a sound thing, but we also have this, we have two, why two? You know, like, and then learning later, you know, why you need to, you know, it's just, there's magic everywhere. And it's a little intimidating at first because you're like, I'll never figure out what all of these machines do and what you need. And, you know, but you just start to get it, you know, like crossing the line. I mean, I don't know. You know, there's things once you direct, once you're in there, you're like, oh, I kind of understand that conceptually. Sure.
You did Man Up with Simon Pegg.
Yes.
And it's interesting because it made me think about the genre of romantic comedies. Which, you know, seemed to be more popular 10 or 15 years ago and seemed to be more like sort of reliable event movies that if you made one fairly decently, people would go out and see it and it would open. And, you know, you had Notting Hill and Four Weddings and a Funeral,
right,
and these kind of films. And this one harkens back to that, even in the sense of like, the meeting place at the beginning of the film under the clock in Paddington Station.
Yeah,
like, and it's very English, and I thought it was a very endearing film. But I wondered if you have an affinity for that genre, or if that was a job to you, or if it was fun to be able to make a sort of a classic romantic comedy.
There's a myriad of reasons why I was super excited about making Man Up, because first off, I do love romantic comedies and I like good ones, and I think that Tess Morris, the writer, wrote something totally classic and yet really funny. So I think it's romantic comedy, you know, so it has more, it's more emphasis on the end there.
Yes.
You know, the idea of playing with, you know, Simon Pegg, I thought, you know, we had a good musicality just, and I knew that would be a fun sort of back and forth. But also, I live there, and so to go back to England, where I went to drama school, where I was a student, and to be, to do this relatively big movie, at least for me.
Yeah.
Playing the lead, doing a comedy, and as a fully realized British character, that was a dream come true. Total bucket list moment. So I fulfilled something very, you know, profoundly exciting for me as an actor, certainly, doing that.
Well, there's certainly enough Brits coming over here and doing American accents and taking a zillion jobs that it's turnabout is fair play. And,
yeah,
and you did fantastic with the accent.
Thank you.
Which is always a thing, I guess.
It is a thing. It's,
yeah,
a thing. In order to be able to, because there's improvisation as well. So in order to kind of, you know, especially with comedy, it's like you don't, you know, I speak very quickly, you know, the way I relate to people and the way, you know, comedically, the musicality that I enjoy ping-ponging is quick. And so in order to feel confident enough and comfortable in the accent and, you know, and in the specificity of that accent and where it was born from and, you know, the color that, especially being in a world obsessed with accents, you know, I really worked very hard to create that character and, you know, work with a dialect coach and really kind of dork out on it. So that was important to me. And so it's like, yeah, it was fun for the romantic comedy of it all, but to play comedy in that way as this, you know, British, in this British mouth, you know, was really challenging, but really, really wonderful.
Well, you pulled it off completely, and it's a really entertaining film.
Good, I'm glad.
You know, of not hanging out in your trailer and learning, it doesn't surprise me, you know, given what you've done in your career, that you've remained a very curious person who's always sort of, like, I really admire how much you have given yourself an education and sort of created your own path. And it's and it shows. It's like you have a completely unique voice in filmmaking. And, you know, when you were coming here to do this show, I was thinking, oh, I'm interviewing a director. I didn't, like, first, even though I don't know if you think of yourself as a director first, I think you have that kind of voice already. And you know, I am wondering what you're going to do next, and I'm looking forward to it. So thank you so much for coming and doing
thank
this.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
It was really, really fun.
Well, come anytime with, you know.
Great. That would be weird if I, like, came every day.
Well, we'd run out of food.
Yeah. Because no. I'm an eater. Breastfeeding. No. I'm breastfeeding. I created life.
No, but I'll cut that. That was terrible that I just...
Are you kidding? That's great.
But
as
but
a director,
you.
That's great.
Thank you very much for doing this.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Hey, folks, you've reached the end of another episode of Off Camera. I hope you're liking the show. And remember, if you want to get the full off-camera experience, go to offcamera.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at @offcameraShow or me at Sam Jones. And if you want to get really personal, send me an email, sam@offcamera.com. Make sure to tune in next time when I sit down with the beautiful, talented, wise Jennifer Beals. See you next time, off camera.